This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. And it's official. Donald Trump is now the Republican nominee. Trump won big in Washington state's primary, so all 44 of our delegates went to him yesterday. And while many of the state's delegates didn't want Trump to be the nominee, Republican State Party Chair Susan Hutchison says they're now coming together. And yesterday, delegates were even dancing on the convention floor.
You know, we were wearing these evergreen hats because we wanted everybody to notice Washington State. We're often forgotten way out in the corner of the map. And so we're the evergreen state. We made these fun foam evergreen hats. And I think everybody in the whole convention thought it was a hoot. And so it was a great moment to be so proud of our state.
You mentioned that Washington is often forgotten about, and I wonder, is that going to change at all this year? Do you think that Washington State could possibly vote for a Republican for president this year after 30 years of not doing that?
I believe, and I've been saying for some time, ever since he was our presumptive nominee, that Donald Trump can flip the state. And we know that the soft Democrats are very, very amenable to a Donald Trump presidency. They feel that he speaks for them. And so I think Hillary Clinton is in big trouble in the state. We already know she's in trouble because of the Bernie Sanders fan club. But, you know, we study the demographics really carefully. And we believe that this is a swing state, not a blue state. And it's just swung to the blue side in the last few elections. You know, our governors win by very slim margins, our Democratic governors. And so when it comes to whether or not it can swing the other direction, it can, but it often is affected by who's at the top of the ticket. So I think that there's a quality about Donald Trump that draws people to believe that he can fix it, that he can get it done. He got it done. He got the nomination out of 17 choices in the very beginning, and now people are beginning to realize he can get it done in America.
What's the path forward for the Trump campaign in Washington State? I mean, given that the western part of the state is increasingly progressive, can he win the state without western Washington?
Well, I think that when you're talking about very progressive, you're talking about Seattle. You know, we have really studied the data, and Pierce County, for example, the second largest county in the state, is a red county now. I don't know if people in Seattle have noticed it, but we sure have. Snohomish County is the most flippable county in the state, and Jay Inslee won it by only 2%. We believe that Snohomish County is our Ohio, and that if we flip Snohomish County, we're going to flip the entire state. The key to our success this year is going to be voter turnout. It's notorious that many of our Republican regions do not turn out even at the statewide average, partly because when they're voting for their local elections, they know the Republican is going to win. But secondly, they believe that Seattle has all the power, and they don't, because we've got more population of registered voters in the other regions of the state outside of Seattle. They just have to vote. And so that's going to be our focus, getting out the vote. It's been how we've won all these legislative seats for the last 3 years. And we believe the momentum is on our side.
Let's talk a little bit about local and statewide races. And I remember hearing earlier on in this cycle from Republican candidates who are really trying to distance themselves from what was going on nationally because the campaign was so negative, it was so divisive. And, you know, I heard from several people, look, I'm just going to focus on the local stuff. I don't want to talk about the national campaigns. Do you hear that still? Is that likely to continue? Are people just really going to focus on local issues?
Well, that is the case, but nothing succeeds like winning. And I think as people begin to see the polls change, no matter what their stance was originally, they're going to want to catch the Trump train. So don't be surprised if some folks reconsider, especially as Donald Trump moves toward his presidential role. And I understand that it's taken people a long time to get used to Donald Trump as a candidate. And I understand that some of our great Republicans are struggling with it already. But, you know, this is the 21st century. We can't go back to Ronald Reagan. We have to move forward. And that's my message to all of our wonderful Republicans that have not yet been able to embrace a Donald Trump presidency. I think as time goes on, they're going to be really pleased. I think Mike Pence was an outstanding choice for vice president. He's a serious choice. I think that the people who are coming around Donald Trump now as his advisors are very skilled, extremely serious people who want the best for America. And then it's the voters. You know, eventually voters convince their friends and their family. And I've been convinced by a lot of the Trump voters. I've listened to them for months, and I've begun to realize that what they're saying is really valid. I keep calling them the canary in the coal mine. Those who started out supporting Donald Trump, what were they saying to us? They were saying to us that we are on the edge, and if we don't take the right steps now, we're going to lose the America that we have known. And that's a very sober message that we've been getting from the Trump supporters.
Mr. Trump will be speaking to the convention tomorrow night. What do you want to hear him say? What does he need to say to unite the Republican Party going forward?
Well, I think his basic message, which is I'm going to get ISIS and I'm going to fix the economy, is the crux of everything he can possibly talk about to have impact on these delegates. I think all of the people who have spoken up to this point are underscoring variations on that theme. And I think that when Donald Trump gets up, there needs to be in his demeanor a sense that we can trust him. We can trust that he's serious, that we can trust that he is going to look out for me, and that he's going to look out for the conservative principles that we stand by. We want America to be the land of opportunity again. We want government to stop regulating everything we do. We want our businesses to be able to thrive. We want our kids to grow up with a sense of freedom and responsibility. These are the things that Republicans stand for. And if he can convince the delegations all through this convention hall that he's serious about representing them, I think that we're going to have an amazing night tomorrow night.
That's Susan Hutchison, chair of the Washington State Republican Party. She was speaking with me from the GOP National Convention in Cleveland. Hutchison says despite the divide in the Washington delegation, she believes most delegates will come around and unite against Hillary Clinton. Tonight at the convention, Senator Ted Cruz is speaking. Hutchison says he'll likely try to persuade his supporters to get behind Trump. In Washington state, voters still have quite a lot of political homework to do. The primary election is underway here, and hopefully you already have your primary ballot in hand. This year, the ballot is especially crowded. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins explains.
If you're a Washington voter and you're like me, you opened your primary ballot and thought, wow, there are a lot of people running for office. 17 candidates for U.S. Senate, 11 for governor, 11 more for lieutenant governor. The smorgasbord of candidates doesn't stop there.
There's a lot of action happening this year. It's packed from start to finish, and we have to do a lot of homework to be ready.
That's Dave Ammons with Washington's Secretary of State's office. Now, it's common for top-of-the-ballot races like Senate and governor to draw a plentitude of candidates, but usually not this many. And this year, something else is fueling Washington's crowded primary ballot. 5 of the 9 statewide office holder positions are open seats, meaning the incumbent isn't running for re-election.
There's a lot of turnover in state offices, the most in modern memory.
The challenge for primary voters is to weed through the list of names and pick just one for each race. Some of the names are familiar. Incumbent U.S. Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat, for instance. The leading Republican in that race is former state GOP chair Chris Vance. But what about the 15 other people running for U.S. Senate? Chances are you've never heard of them before. Most are first-time or non-traditional candidates. TVW, the state's C-SPAN network, has produced a video voter's guide featuring many of them, like Donna Lands, who prefers the Conservative Party and offers this explanation for her candidacy.
I saved my babysitting money to get my name on the ballot because my hubby said I could spend it any way I want it to. I chose to spend it this way.
Lands calls herself the outsider of outsiders. There's also Pano Churchill, who prefers something called the Lincoln Caucus Party.
We need to claim back our country from the D.C. insiders, from the narrow-minded establishment, and from the stale political parties.
Again, that's Washington's race for U.S. Senate. In the governor's race, incumbent Democrat Jay Inslee and Republican challenger Bill Bryant are the leading candidates, but they've got plenty of company on the ballot. From perennial candidate Good Space Guy, who wants to save Seattle's waterfront viaduct.
Let's not destroy Seattle's viaduct. Let's park on it instead.
To David Blumstrom of the Fifth Republic Party.
The obvious problem no one wants to talk about is the blob, our bloated education and bureaucracy.
The largest slate of candidates for an open seat is for Washington's lieutenant governor. The longtime holder of that office, Brad Owen, is retiring. Among those vying to replace him are three Democratic state senators, Karen Frazier, Cyrus Habib, and Steve Hobbs. The leading Republican candidate, based on fundraising totals, is former CNBC news anchor Philip Yin. But primary voters have other choices in this race, too, like Mark Green, who prefers the Citizens Party.
I am not a global citizen. Far from it. I'm an American, period. Votes for me will once again signify the resurgence of commoners in our state and our nation.
Washington primary voters will also find a lengthy list of choices for superintendent of public instruction and commissioner of public lands, as well as state auditor and state treasurer, all open seats. All told, more than 670 candidates are running in Washington's primary, but history suggests only about 4 in 10 registered voters will cast a primary ballot. That means it's the 40% who will decide the top two challengers in each race to advance to the general election, when more than 80% of voters are expected to turn out. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
For more on the candidates for local and statewide offices, you can find links at our website, kuow.org. The Secretary of State also has a primary election voters guide, and TVW has a video voters guide. We're tweeting out links to those now. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm Deborah Wong, filling in for Bill Radke. If you live in Seattle and you're getting ready to vote in this primary election, you'll be faced with an important question, whether to double our current housing levy to pay for more affordable housing. It's Proposition 1 on your ballot. So to help you make your decision, we're talking with Brianna McDonald. She's a Seattle homeowner who wrote the opposition statement on Prop 1 in the Voters Guide. And Kelly Ryder with the nonprofit Housing Development Consortium. Kelly wants Seattle voters to vote yes on Prop 1 because she says it continues the work Seattle has been doing to create more affordable housing.
We know that right now 3,000 Seattle school students have been identified as homeless. Nearly 3,000 individuals were identified as homeless during the one-night count, completely unsheltered. And 47,000 households are paying more than half their income for housing, placing them just one emergency away from homelessness. So at a time where we know that Seattle voters have stood up time and again to build a legacy, Seattle now has over 12,000 affordable homes that they've been able to produce, making sure that we can continue upon that legacy to address today's critical affordable housing crisis, I think is more important than ever.
All right. And so let's go through some of the numbers. This is $290 million over 7 years. So for the average homeowner in Seattle, it's about $122 a year, which is about twice what we're paying now. Basically, what do we get for that money?
So a significant amount of that is making sure that we can build over 2,100 new affordable homes. Those will be affordable for 50 years and serve households that in affordable housing jargon are making less than 60% of area median income, or an individual making less than $40,000 a year, or a four-person household making less than $55,000 a year. So that's just to make sure that we can create inclusive, diverse neighborhoods, that we're not just getting expensive apartments in our neighborhoods, but that we're able to make sure that people who earn low and modest wages are able to live here in this city and aren't getting displaced. We're also going to, as part of the levy, make sure that we can provide services within those homes, particularly for chronically homeless individuals, people with disabilities, people who are really struggling to remain permanently housed. And we're also going to be able to serve 4,500 households with homelessness prevention dollars. So these are families that are at risk of eviction that had that emergency come up and they're not sure how they're going to pay that next rent check. For these families, this small amount of money is going to make sure that they can stay in their homes.
Okay, so that's the argument, beginning of the argument for this levy. Brianna, what's the argument against this levy?
Well, as a homeowner, I look at my property taxes in a cumulative fashion. So I understand that the cost of the levy in and of itself is not very much, but cumulatively, we have passed 7 levies over the course of the last 5 years, which has increased property taxes going on their number of $480,000 for a tax assessed value home of $400 a month. And there are more measures on the ballot this fall for increases in property taxes. And so what I want to see from the city is solutions that address the problems at hand. I am not against affordable housing. I'm actually very much for affordable housing. That said, they called this a solution to homelessness in 2009. And today, as Kelly pointed out, we have a homelessness crisis on our hands. So what's not working with this policy that we are now facing this crisis? Seattle is the 11th fastest growing state city in the nation right now. And as we continue to grow these essentially Band-Aid solutions to help individuals and don't really address the causes of problems, will continue to cost taxpayers more dollars, because all of those individuals that will not be helped by this levy still end up costing taxpayers and property owners.
I want to just break that down, because it sounds like you have a couple of things there. One is just the cost of the levy. You feel like as a homeowner, you've been sort of nickeled and dimed by the city over the last few years as sort of levy upon levy has been, had landed on your shoulders?
Yes and no. So yes, in the fact that I hear the yes side for affordable housing, and yes, they've met all their numbers, they've exceeded their goals. But I look outside and I see with my eyes that we have a crisis on our hands with what is going on with homelessness and affordability in the city. And it's affordability for all people as the cost of living continues to go up here in this city. And then I also see it cumulatively with the different levies that we have passed, that I'm just not seeing the progress and the investment of my tax dollars being used effectively. And I want to be able to invest in my city and see results. And I'm not seeing that today. And so it's concerning. So the King County executive and the mayor filed for a state of emergency in November of last year. And with this levy coming up on the ballot, I really felt this was an opportunity for the city to look at this levy and say, hey, what's working? What's not? What could we do to improve this levy? But instead, what came out was, let's just double it. And I feel like we need a more comprehensive solution to lift people up and out, because we have a disappearing middle class in this city that needs to be addressed as well. And by helping to lift people up and out, I believe we could actually rebuild the middle class at the same time and help people who are also struggling.
Kelly, what's your response to that? Homelessness numbers, we're spending more money on affordable housing. We're seeing more homeless people on the street. What is not working?
Yeah, the homelessness numbers are staggering. And we know that the federal government has disinvested from creating affordable housing for the last several decades. We know that our mental health system in this state is broken, and people aren't getting the mental health system care that they need. And we also know that coming out of the recession, we've gotten a lot of job creation, but it's either been really high paying job that is helping to increase rents, or it's been extremely low paying jobs, which is helping to prevent people from being able to afford that rent. And so we've really got this dichotomy right now. What this levy will do will ensure that we can have an inclusive housing choices for Seattle workers and families.
But once again, it only covers a very small percentage of people who are facing this struggle right now. It doesn't really fully address the problem at hand. It's been called not a complete solution. It's a piece of the puzzle. And so as a property owner in this city, at what point do we say to the city that we want some real solutions that we can invest up front and not have to continue paying for puzzle pieces or only part solutions or only part helping people?
So this is going to be one step forward. The mayor came out last year with 65 recommendations that he believes all needs to happen in order for us to fully address our affordable housing challenges. Some of those can be some of those steps can be taken by the federal government, some by the state government, some by the city council. This is one step that Seattle voters get the opportunity to choose for themselves between now and August 2nd to make sure that we can put these homes on the ground.
With a 35-year-old policy, though, I don't feel like one step forward.
It's a 35-year best practice that cities across the country are emulating and trying to make sure that they have dollars on the ground to help leverage other investments from the federal government, from the state government. We're able to make sure with this money that we can create, that we can draw down $3 for every $1 that the city of Seattle invests.
So
and without
the
these dollars,
being helped,
those investments may not happen.
So for the people that aren't being helped, then where does that money then come from?
We need more local solutions. We need a better tax structure.
Where does the money come from? It comes from property owners. So why not? If
for the
we're
Seattle housing levy,
if,
it would come
we're already
from.
Having to pay property taxes for a Seattle housing levy, why not come up with a comprehensive solution that addresses the problems at hand?
Kelly, clearly in the city of Seattle, you know, people are pretty generous. Voters here have voted for a housing levy for the past 30 years. But is there a sense that this might be a qualitatively bigger ask or a more difficult ask because you're talking about doubling the levy? It feels like so much more. And what I'm hearing is, you know, people pause when they hear that number. It's doubling. Do you worry about that moving forward in this campaign, that people might just think it's too much and that maybe we're not getting enough for it?
Right. I think we've certainly gotten some questions like that. I think we've also, though, gotten a lot of the concerns that I think I'm also hearing from Brianna, which is we need more. This isn't enough. And so I think this is a balanced measure that makes sure that we can make significant strides forward, that makes sure that we're tackling the problem from different angles, that we're making sure that we're giving homeless individuals stable housing to get off the streets, that we're making sure that seniors, people with disabilities are able to have a safe, stable home, but we're also making sure that families have the opportunity to stay in their home. And even part of this measure would support affordable homeownership for families to make sure that we are allowing seniors some home repair dollars for those who are struggling with some challenges in their home and are just trying to stay in their home. So I think more than ever right now, people are asking for larger solutions on affordable housing. And so to me, this is voters being able to do what they can while we work with, again, all of those other strategies that we need to be able to tackle this across the income spectrum.
So, you know, You've got the microphones. This is your last pitch to voters who are literally sitting there with their ballots at their kitchen table. Give me the elevator pitch. Why should you vote for? Why should you vote against?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Kelly.
Proposition 1 will allow the city to continue its legacy of investments in affordable housing at a time that the city is struggling, that residents are struggling to stay in their communities. The simple cost of $5 more per month for the typical or median homeowner means that it's going to be a smart, prudent investment towards addressing our significant affordable housing crisis today. And that's why so many people have agreed that voting yes on Proposition 1 is the right thing to do. We've seen in the last week the League of Women Voters, the Seattle Times, the Municipal League, and the Stranger all agree, along with the unanimous support of the City Council and Mayor Murray, along with businesses, nonprofit organizations, and others. So we hope that voters will join us in voting yes on Proposition 1 by August 2nd.
Brianna, voting against?
As a homeowner, I would just encourage people to sit down and think about the levies cumulatively that we have been asked to pay for and will have to continue to pay for going forward. And if this solution is comprehensive enough to address the problems that our city faces today, and if we are happy with the fact that our city keeps creating policies that do not address actual causes to the problem versus just continue to create puzzle pieces that fit together somehow to create solutions. So I would like to be able to see a policy put in place that is comprehensive, has a bigger investment up front with long-term solutions and less cost in the long run and be more proactive in terms of the policy that we're addressing. So as a homeowner, I would just encourage people to look at their ballots and see if this is something that they truly believe will help address the problems that exist today, or if they think that the city could do better with the policies they're creating.
All right. Thank you very much, both of you. Brianna McDonald, a Seattle homeowner who wrote the statement in opposition for the Voter's Guide, and Kelly Ryder, Government Relations and Policy Director for the Housing Development Consortium. You should have your ballots now already. and you will need to fill them out and drop them off by August 2nd. This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. A few years ago, local kayak teacher Susan Conrad decided she was going to paddle the Inside Passage, 1,200 miles from the lower Puget Sound, through British Columbia and the Great Bear Rainforest, and up to Skagway, Alaska. Here's the catch. She wanted to do it by herself.
The entire route is replete with thousands of islands scattered throughout it. There are steep-walled fjords and wide ocean passages, glaciers that creep down to the sea and then the icebergs that cap off of those glaciers. There's whales and coastal wolves and bears, of course. Waterfalls practically around every corner in the northern reaches. It's just a stunningly beautiful part of this world.
But the Inside Passage isn't all idyllic and breathtaking views. In a kayak by yourself, it's also pretty dangerous. Susan Conway met Ross Reynolds down at the Agua Verde Kayak Club in the University District, and she explained that one of the reasons she wanted to make that treacherous journey was to get away from her life here in Seattle.
My life seemed really off kilter. My father had recently passed away, and my long-term relationship was falling apart. My cat had died. I sound like a country western song. A dear friend had passed away. Another had moved away. I was pitifully out of shape and making some really poor choices in my life. Probably drinking too much wine in the evening, partying, you know, just not hanging out with people that were conducive to my life's goals and where I wanted to be. And I've always been this person that has this insatiable curiosity to know what's around the next corner. And I so desperately needed a next corner. So the Inside Passage became my next corner. You know, the Inside Passage is touted as the most scenic and challenging paddling route in all of North America. So that was definitely a lure, that holy grailness sort of thing.
What was the low point?
The low point would put me in a 100-mile-long channel referred to as Grenville Channel. The locals call it the Ditch, south of Prince Rupert in British Columbia. And it's a 100-mile-long steep-walled fjord that's just about arrow straight. And it's a stunningly beautiful portion of the Inside Passage, but it's also the most remote and wildest and steepest section. And so I was working my way through the ditch and getting toward the northern end, and I'd already had three consecutive sleepless nights because it's an area that's prone to extreme tidal differences. So we're talking minus tides all the way up to like 24 to 25 foot high tides that would totally obliterate my campsites. They would be underwater in the middle of the night. So, I mean, I knew that and I'm dealing with that every night. I'm worried about grizzly bears. And so, you know, that really affects your beauty sleep. So I'm dealing with that. And so as I get toward the northern end of Grenville Channel, I'm frantically looking for a campsite, and this is an area where there are, again, the grizzly bears with cubs on every beach. So I just keep going and going till I paddled almost 40 miles. I'm averaging like 20 to 25. So I had done nearly 40 miles that day. So I'm just absolutely exhausted, and now I'm getting hypothermic. I'm starting to shiver. I'm getting quite worried, and gale force winds are starting to go up the channel now, and there is just nowhere to get out of this kind of condition. So long story short, I ended up choosing a really, really marginal campsite, and I pull into that, and I know that it's going to drain to, you know, a marsh at low tide, and then it's going to be totally flooded at high tide. And I was just beside myself, and it was definitely a low point of the trip, and I actually had my finger on my VHF radio. That's how I would call for help. And I was rehearsing what I would say when the Coast Guard or whoever answered. And then just this rage kicked in, you know, like this life-giving rage, I think it was, where I just started screaming at the top of my lungs. And I was screaming at the wind and at the rain and at everything and at nothing all at the same time. I mean, my voice was hoarse for days afterward. But I think that pressed that mental reset button where I'm like, okay, Susan, you put yourself in this position. You got to figure a way out. This is getting pretty serious. So I did. I did figure a way out. And the tarp mysteriously cooperated. I got the tent up. I got into dry clothes, I made myself something to eat, and then I finally climbed it in the tent later that night and convinced myself I was going to wake up alive.
You had goals in this trip that you document in your book, Inside. Did you achieve those goals at the end?
I think I did, yeah. My biggest goal was just to experience everything the Inside Passage could offer me and to, you know, accept all those challenges that were placed in my path. I just wanted to see how I would deal with adversity.
What did you learn about yourself when it comes to dealing with adversity?
I learned that I can be quite stubborn, which is a good thing. And I also learned that I can be patient, because the sea will teach you patience. But the biggest thing that I took away from this was more of an awareness that this journey was going to become, or was on its way already, of becoming a paradigm for my life's journey. And that the very same strength and courage that had gotten me up the Inside Passage was going to be that same strength and courage that was going to get me through the, you know, the tumultuous seas of everyday life. And I realized that, you know, I could accomplish anything that I set my mind to, you know, whatever that challenge might be in, you know, everyday life, and that everything that I needed to accomplish, whatever goal, was already inside me.
That's Susan Conrad. Her memoir about her 1,200-mile solo kayak journey is called Inside, One Woman's Journey Through the Inside Passage. She spoke with KUOW's Ross Reynolds down by the waterfront. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. We're live tweeting at KUOW. Heroin addiction has been steadily rising in King County over the last decade. But there's a glimmer of good news this week, thankfully. According to brand new data, heroin overdose deaths fell by 15% last year. University of Washington researcher Caleb Banta-Green co-authored the new report. He told KUOW's Kim Malcolm about why heroin deaths are declining.
We know from medical research that if you distribute the antidote naloxone to enough heroin users and their friends and family in the community, you will see a decline in deaths. We saw this in the state of Massachusetts. We also know that if you get people onto methadone maintenance or buprenorphine for opiate addiction treatment, their chance of dying is cut in half. So we know that the interventions we're putting into place work. The medical research is very clear on that. So it looks like as we implement these interventions that we know work, that we're starting to see some of those positive rewards locally.
Caleb, that leads me to the next question. I visited a mock supervised consumption site, a drug consumption site in Seattle this week. These are places where drug users can get clean supplies and use drugs in a safe, supervised setting. Do you think they're a good idea?
I do think they're a good idea. I think that the existing medical research shows that they have positive health impacts. And I also think that they make sense in a continuum of care. Right now, for instance, we have wonderful syringe exchange services in King County. We distributed 7 million clean syringes to injection drug users in King County last year. We gave them counseling. We gave them medical care. We gave them clean supplies. And then we said, good luck finding a place to use. Hope you don't overdose. So the idea is that you're providing all these services. It seems logical from a health perspective to also allow those people to use in a safe place and be medically monitored. It keeps them alive then and there, which is valuable in and of itself. And when those folks are ready to access other services, whether it's healthcare, mental health care, housing, opioid addiction treatment, you've already made those connections and relationships. They're already there. So to co-locate those services makes good sense. To provide the services of a safe consumption facility and also then be able to directly link them to a whole other range of services so that people can get more stable and more healthy.
This report also finds that meth is an increasing problem, especially people are dying from it. What's going on here?
So methamphetamine is a very serious drug associated with substantial addiction and to some degree mortality. But for almost a decade, we saw about 20 methamphetamine-involved deaths per year. And in 2015, we saw 86. That's a huge increase. That's 86 out of the 320 drug-caused deaths we saw in the county. So it's a lot more methamphetamine-involved deaths, and about half of that was with heroin, and that's very, very new, just in the last 3 to 4 years, that people are mixing methamphetamine and heroin. That's called a goofball. Speedball is mixing cocaine and heroin. That's been around for a long time. That's actually declined. And what's happened is cocaine became a little bit harder to get for a while. And so surprisingly, people actually switched to methamphetamine. And also, unfortunately, it turns out that that is deadly, that combining heroin with methamphetamine is a deadly combination.
This report is kind of like a snapshot of where we are right now. What hope does it give you for the future?
Sure. So I've been writing these reports for 15 years. And it feels like perhaps we are seeing a bit of a bending of the curve in terms of opiate overdoses. So I see hope that, yes, we're increasing services, but if we continue to increase them even more, we will have an even bigger impact on overdose death. Right now, almost 3/4 of drug-caused deaths involve opiates. All of those deaths are preventable. The condition of opiate addiction is a manageable condition. We should be able to get rid of almost all of those deaths if we're providing adequate services. And I feel like we're starting to see perhaps a bending of the curve, maybe the first sign that these interventions are really having an impact. And it makes me hopeful that if we continue to expand these services, we'll see an even greater impact.
Caleb Banta-Green is a senior researcher at the University of Washington's Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute. He spoke with KUW's Kim Malcolm about a recent decline in heroin overdoses. Last year, 132 people died from heroin in King County. That's down from 156 in 2014, and that 2014 number was an all-time high. This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. It's time for our weekly chat about Canada with Vaughn Palmer, who's a columnist for the Vancouver Sun, who joins us now. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Deborah.
So I wanted to ask you actually about the big political news on this side of the border. Donald Trump is officially the Republican nominee for President of the United States. So how much are Canadians paying attention to all of this, and what's the response been?
Well, I would say riveted, but maybe that's just because I'm a political junkie. It's fascinating. Follow American politics. Canadians follow it pretty closely. We've got a pretty big stake in the United States in terms of trading partnerships and other issues. And with Trump, I think it's the unknown quantity that's the big issue. Most American presidential nominees, as Canadians look at them, fit into a pattern. They have experience in government. They're familiar with international trade agreements. They've even if, you know, there's issues where we disagree, they're seen as more or less mainstream people. I think the thing with Trump is because you just don't know what he's going to do. He gave a speech in Washington State earlier this year where he announced that NAFTA was the worst trade agreement in history and implied that he might tear it up. Well, we're kind of fond of NAFTA up here, and the idea of Trump is, as I say, is just what would he do, and I think most Canadians really don't honestly know what he would do. Of course, that might be true with Americans, too.
Well, it's kind of a running joke. You hear Trump detractors saying, if he's elected to the presidency, I'm moving to Canada. I'm sure you've heard the joke. Are you expecting an influx of disillusioned Americans up in your country?
You know, I've been doing this job long enough now, 3 or 4 decades that I've been through this story before. That kind of talk you hear, we heard it around the time Ronald Reagan, now much beloved as a president, was first elected. Americans are going to move to Canada. We heard it with the second Bush, particularly his second term. The actual data on this suggests it doesn't happen, that Americans stay home. They grin and bear it, whether they like their new president or not. The only really significant exodus of Americans to Canada in modern times was during the Vietnam War, and those were mostly draft dodgers. That's the only time that you've really seen a lot of Americans come to Canada for political reasons, and it was because of the draft.
Now, I understand there are actually some folks who are having fun with this as well. What's going on there?
So the British Columbia Lottery Corporation, which is the government-owned company that runs our casinos and our lottery games, allows you to do what they call novelty betting. And whether or not Americans might think it's a novelty bet to have met in American elections, they're enjoying a pretty hot business. Lottery Corporation says more British Columbians are betting on the American election this year than bet on the outcome of the Oscar race. The odds, if you're interested, are Trump 2-1, Clinton 2-5. Most Canadians are betting on Clinton. Interesting thing about this, when they first started taking bets in early 2015, Trump was 100-1. So if you put down $10 back then, you'd get back 1,000. Now it's a little more orthodox. People up here concede he does have a chance. I guess he does.
Well, Donald Trump is, of course, a real estate tycoon. So let's move on from the elections and talk about real estate, because there's some new data out about Vancouver's real estate market, which you found interesting. Tell us about it.
Yeah, the British Columbia government is embroiled in a lot of controversy over to what degree offshore money is driving up prices in and around the city of Vancouver. And there's been a huge escalation in prices. And the government stopped keeping data here about 15, 20 years ago on the whether or not people buying homes and real estate were Canadians or foreigners. They stopped doing it. They started doing it again in June. And for the first time, we have data again, and it's pretty interesting. For the first 19 days of keeping data, so this is the last 3 weeks of June of this year, $400 million worth of real estate snapped up by foreigners, mostly Chinese citizens, in British Columbia in just little under 3 weeks. So it's a big real estate boom here. It's only 5% of sales, but I think that's gotten a lot of people's attention. It is really a factor in the real estate market. And of course, Deborah, you're now hearing people saying, well, we need to put up some kind of barrier to this happening, maybe a special tax on people who don't live here, who buy real estate here, or people who aren't Canadians buying real estate here. It's been done in some other places. It may well be done here in British Columbia.
So how have people responded to that news? Because I can imagine that, you know, you might have a lot of differing opinions. You might have property owners who say, hey, this is great because it's lifting up my real estate prices. But you might have people who are trying to get into the real estate market saying it's making things absolutely unaffordable.
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, you're hearing both reactions. You're hearing people who own property or were going, well, they don't want to undercut the value of their property. They're looking at, you know, maybe passing the house on to their children when they retire or selling it and moving into a smaller place. It's great for them. The government's making a lot of money off it, too. They already charge a tax on all real estate sales, and that's running at record levels. The other thing you're hearing, too, and I think, you know, you're hearing some reservations from people about a kind of racial overtone to a lot of this controversy, that it's kind of directed at Chinese, and you should be careful about that. There are a lot of Chinese Canadians and a lot of landed immigrants in Canada who are also engaged in the real estate market. Just because you have a Chinese name doesn't mean you're not a Canadian and doesn't mean that you're not just speculating because you're in business. So there's a fairly wide diversity of debate around this issue. My guess, though, is that the government, it's hitting such an extraordinary level that the government, either provincial or national or both, will do something to rein in some of the real estate speculation. There's a recognition here that we've created a real estate bubble. Americans know what those can lead to in terms of an economic crisis.
Vaughn, one last question. You may not be expecting an influx of Americans in November, but you are seeing an influx of whales recently. Can you tell us what's going on?
Yeah, the whale watching companies in both British Columbia and Washington State the humpbacks are back, you know, and they were hunted almost to extinction before whaling was finally outlawed in the 1960s. I think there were only about 1,600 of them left in these waters. We're now back to, 21,000? The whale watching companies who've been following orcas around for a long time, and yes, folks, I know they're not whales, are now saying humpbacks are everywhere. So it's kind of exciting. It's nice to have the whales back.
Yeah, and it's nice to end on a little bit of good news. So thank you, Vaughn Palmer from the Vancouver Sun. It's nice to talk to you.
Talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Bye. And you've been listening to The Record on KUOW. And make sure you tune in for live coverage of the Republican National Convention tonight, starting at 6 p.m. I'm Deborah Wong. Thank you for joining us.